The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
When President-elect Biden takes office, he's expected to quickly reverse several Trump rules, including a travel ban against people coming from Muslim-majority nations.
By overturning the ban, which is the lowest-hanging fruit, he can signal that, you know what, I take immigration seriously.
And climate scientists are getting better at measuring sea level rise.
The Earth is a big place, and to measure all of it in a short period of time, really, the only way to do it is from space.
A new satellite to give better views on how our world is changing. Also today, a hurricane season like none other pounds Central America.
So Honduras is going through a very, very, very difficult and sad time.
How children cope with the storms. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is Thursday. Glad you could make it here. In Europe, a high-stakes political game is playing out. In one corner are Hungary, Poland, and Slovenia. In the other, the rest of Europe. At the center of it all is a jackpot worth $2.1 trillion. That is the EU budget, including emergency funding for economies reeling from the pandemic. Earlier this week, Hungary and Poland effectively vetoed that budget. Leaders of all 27 EU member states were meeting online today. I spoke with our Europe correspondent Orla Barry earlier to find out why Hungary and Poland are holding up the budget process.
Well, very simply, Marco, because the EU proposed that the funding would be linked to a rule of law mechanism. In other words, that EU money could be withheld from countries that are seen to breach EU principles or indeed mishandle EU funds. And this is a problem for Hungary and Poland because both countries know that the EU already disapproves of how they've been seen to gradually dilute democratic norms, essentially in the way that they've taken over independent media and how they've reduced the independence of their judiciary. Only a few weeks ago, Hungary proposed changes to the country's electoral laws, which could make it very difficult for opposition parties to ever get into power. The problem up to now has been, while the EU has disapproved of all of this, there's very little it could do because if it proposed any action against Hungary, for example, Poland would then veto the action and vice versa. But this new conditionality would change things somewhat and it means they could be in danger of losing EU money.
I mean, won't Hungary and Poland also lose out if the bill isn't passed? Vetoing this budget means they won't receive any recovery funding, right?
Right, exactly. And I should point out that Poland actually currently receives more EU funds than any other country in the European Union. So it stands to lose a lot. And Hungary, by the way, used to be the largest recipient per capita of EU money. The thing is, there's a reason these negotiations are being compared to a poker game, because right now everyone is wondering who'll fold first. What Poland and Hungary may be banking on is the fact that they can afford to wait it out a little longer than some of their southern neighbours to get their hands on the financial aid. Because if you look at Italy, for example, which was very badly hit by the pandemic first time around, they've been very badly hit again this time around, and they're concerned that their economy is effectively paralysed. So it's quite possible that Poland and Hungary are thinking, well, the EU will have to cave in because countries like Italy and Spain will put them under pressure to do so.
So how's this all being viewed by the general public in Poland and Hungary? Are they angry with their leaders for bad governance?
Well, you have to bear in mind that in Hungary in particular, the majority of the media is government-owned or government-supported. So many of the public will only be getting the news that the government wants to hear. That said, in Hungary yesterday, six opposition parties did come together and issue a joint statement saying that Prime Minister Viktor Orban is not operating in the nation's interests. But it's been interesting to see what the prime ministers of both countries have been saying back home, because it's not exactly what they have been saying to the EU are in Brussels. And I spoke to Daniel Hegedus about this with the German Marshall Fund.
Yesterday, Prime Minister Orban argued that it's practically a punishment for those countries who object to illegal immigration, and that the EU would like to blackmail Hungary to let in asylum seekers in the country, which is de facto not true. And in the case of Poland, even the argumentation was used that through this rule of law mechanism, the European Union tries to push Poland to recognize gay marriage.
And Hegedűs made the point, this is something the Polish government has been saying since 2005. And actually, it's completely untrue, because the EU doesn't have the legal ability to interfere in areas like this, like gay marriage, etc.
So, Orla, what's likely to happen now? Is there a possible end to this deadlock?
Today, it seems unlikely that anything will be resolved. There are indications that some MEPs are looking for ways to compromise or at least work a way around this. There are a number of options open to the EU, Marco, but at the moment it does seem both sides are sort of waiting to see who will cave first. But I asked Daniel Hegedűs from the German Marshall Fund what he thinks will happen.
I would like to give a very simple answer, which is that the European member states have much better cards, but politicians like Prime Minister Orbán bluff much better. Having a Mexican standoff with Poland and Hungary and the European Parliament is, I think, a political scenario everyone would like to avoid.
And one other thing to bear in mind is that the majority of the public in Poland and Hungary are actually very pro-EU. There was a survey of all the countries last year, and Poland topped the board as having the most favourable view of the European Union. So this is something both prime ministers will have to bear in mind.
The World's Orla Barry on the European Economic Recovery beat for us today. Thank you very much, Orla.
You're welcome, Marco.
January 20th is 2 months away, but President-elect Joe Biden is already planning to sign a flurry of executive orders after being sworn in. One of them is likely to end President Trump's travel ban against many Muslim-majority nations. That's impacted many people abroad and also families here in the U.S. KQED's Farida Jabvala Romero caught up with an Iranian-American doctor who for years has tried to bring his father to live with him.
In March, Armand Derry was consumed with worry. His father, a doctor, was hospitalized with COVID-19 in Tehran.
He's 81 years old, and that's the biggest risk factor for COVID-19.
But Derry, who's also a doctor, lives in Visalia, a small city in California more than 7,000 miles away from Iran. That distance compounded his fear. He couldn't just go care for his dad.
That was a very tough time. It was very scary.
Derry and his sister are both naturalized U.S. citizens. 5 years ago, they applied for green cards for their parents. Their mother's was approved in 2016, but their father's got stuck in limbo after President Donald Trump issued the travel ban during his first days in office.
It's been a burden, a huge burden on our shoulders, on our minds. Yeah, it's been very difficult for all of us.
The Trump administration has invoked national security to bar travel to the U.S. for many people from some Muslim-majority countries. Critics challenged the ban in court as discriminatory and racist. An amended version didn't go into full effect until December 2017, after the Supreme Court allowed it to move forward. Earlier this year, Trump added more African and Asian countries to its banned travel list, for a total of 13.
The harm that it has done to the reputation of the country and to the people and communities it's impacted is so immeasurable.
Max Wolson is a lawyer with the National Immigration Law Center in Washington, D.C., which sued to end the travel ban. He says the impact goes way beyond the more than 41,000 visa requests denied from people in blocked countries. And, Wolson says, that total doesn't include the thousands of other requests that might have been put on hold or people too discouraged to apply.
Every child that you keep separate from their parent, every person who misses a wedding, and every person who misses a job opportunity, those don't just hurt the person involved. They hurt the people that would benefit from being reunited with their family members. They hurt the places that these people would end up working.
Biden could undo the travel ban just the way Trump started it, with an executive order. That would trigger a reversal at the State Department, Customs and Border Protection, and other federal agencies. Abed Ayoub with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, says if Biden ends the travel ban as promised, it would signal a new start on how the U.S. treats immigrants, including protecting young immigrants brought to the country as children and reuniting separated migrant families.
You know, by overturning the ban, which is the lowest hanging fruit, he can signal to the communities that, you know what, I take immigration seriously. I take your concerns seriously.
Dr. Armin Derry, whose father is still in Iran, came to the U.S. more than a decade ago to work in clinical trials and do a residency at a prestigious clinic in Ohio. But the travel ban made him feel like he wasn't welcome in the U.S. And he says getting rid of it would lift a weight off his family and many others.
It's going to be a huge relief for people who are affected by this unjust and discriminative act. It means a lot for us.
Derry's dad has recovered from COVID. Now, he hopes he can finally come live with his son in California. For The World, I'm Farida Javala Romero.
We may not hear about them much, but more than 700 U.S. troops are currently stationed in Somalia. In the coming days, the Trump administration is planning to remove most, if not all of them. It's time to come home. The quick drawdown could be devastating for Somalia. U.S. troops there have been propping up Somalia's faltering government after years of war and strife. They've been training and equipping an elite Somali fighting force that's kept the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab at bay. Omar Mahmoud is a senior analyst for Somalia at the International Crisis Group and joins us from Nairobi. Omar, what is likely to be the most immediate impact of a U.S. troop drawdown?
The unit that the U.S. has been training has gotten high marks for its operations and its ability to really engage al-Shabaab. And so any sort of sudden withdrawal immediately calls that training into question.
Somalia's government collapsed in 1991, and it's been struggling ever since. What exactly have the 700 U.S. troops been doing there?
Yeah, so the U.S. is focused on building the Somali National Army from the bottom up. And so to do that, they've taken this approach where they're trying to build an elite unit. So right now, you have various components of the National Army. It's not very coherent. There's no command and control structure. And so rather what the U.S. did was focus on this particular unit and try to build that up in a manner where it can start to take over primary security force responsibility, where it can start to engage the militants.
U.S. forces, we should mention, are also stationed in neighboring Djibouti and in Kenya, where you are. What's happening to them, as far as you know, and will they take on any of the role left by the departing American troops in Somalia?
In Djibouti and Kenya, I mean, they very much will probably still pick up some of the slack, but you can't really make up by not having ground troops there. So, you know, even if there's still some support given to the Somali National Army and coming out of Kenya and coming out of Djibouti, it won't really make up for the lack of on-the-ground presence, the lack of in-person training.
What about the Trump administration's argument that U.S. troops cannot stay in places like Somalia forever?
I mean, I think everyone agrees that in the long term, foreign troops should go home and will go home. The question is just when. And honestly, the timing for this might be particularly complicated because Somalia is also headed into elections, an election season. And Somalia elections aren't your typical elections, but rather they take place in certain parts of the country only that are get some extra attention and some extra security. And this time, they're going to actually add some new locations to that. So there's a bit of a security pressure there right now. But I think in the long run, everyone agrees that troops need to go home. But there's some conditions on the ground that everyone wants to see first. And those are the two I mentioned before in terms of upgrading Somali security forces and degrading al-Shabaab.
I just want to mention, too, the fighting in Ethiopia, because neighboring Ethiopia had deployed thousands of peacekeeping troops to Somalia, but some of the soldiers have now been pulled out. Others have been disarmed, as Ethiopia has its own fighting in its northern Tigray region. What will that unrest in Ethiopia mean for Somalia?
Yeah, I mean, Ethiopia has been another key security guarantor in Somalia. And so what happened is Ethiopia has troops both within the African Union mission and then outside of that. And so they pulled their troops outside of the mission, most of them. And now it was never quite clear what agreement those troops were operating under. But the main point is that, again, a sudden pullout opens up a bit of a vacuum and creates security vulnerabilities, which a group like al-Shabaab could very much step into.
Omar Mahmoud is a senior analyst for Somalia at the International Crisis Group. He's been speaking with us from Nairobi. Omar, thanks very much for talking us through this.
I'm glad to be here.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Since the late 1800s, global sea levels have risen about 8 inches. In recent years, the rate of rise has more than doubled. We know that largely from a series of satellites deployed in the early 1990s that measure the level of the world's oceans from space. The next member of that family of satellites will launch on Saturday. As the world's Carolyn Beeler reports, it's expected to give scientists the clearest picture yet of local variations in sea level rise.
The new Sentinel-6 satellite will orbit more than 800 miles above Earth, but be able to capture the height of the global oceans below within a few millimeters of accuracy.
Satellites give us the global view of how the climate's changing.
Josh Willis is NASA's lead mission scientist on the project.
The Earth is a big place, and to measure all of it in a short period of time, really the only way to do it is from space.
When I talked to Willis on Zoom, he had an illustration of the Sentinel-6 satellite as his background.
So I'll do my best weatherman impersonation. So here we have a cold front. I'm just kidding. No, this is the satellite. It looks
the Sentinel-6
like
is scheduled to launch Saturday from California. It's the size of a small car, shaped kind of like a house, with solar panels forming what
shingles.
Looks like an A-frame roof.
Down here on the bottom, right there, is the main instrument, which is a radar.
And that radar shoots a radar wave down at the ocean.
And measures how long it takes to come back. And that tells us how far away the ocean is.
Which tells them basically how high the water is. The Sentinel-6 was developed along with the European Space Agency at the same time as a second satellite that will go up after it. Together, they'll measure rising seas for the next decade, as opposed to a few years at a time for past missions.
It's like a recognition from the community that we can't just stop measuring sea level rise. It's going to continue, and in a lot of ways, this satellite is our best tool for predicting the next 10 or 20 years of sea level rise.
That's key, says Sushmita Dasgupta, a World Bank environmental economist.
Sea level rise is a major threat in a changing climate because it is virtually certain that sea level will keep on rising for centuries, even if greenhouse gas emissions are stabilized today.
That means island nations, low-lying coastal areas, and the hundreds of millions of people who live there are at the highest risk.
So we really need to prepare for this threat.
NASA says this satellite will collect the most accurate data yet on global sea levels. Craig Donlin, Sentinel-6 mission scientist with the European Space Agency, explains that it's the first satellite of its kind to use a relatively new kind of radar. Instead of a regular old altimeter, it has something called a synthetic aperture radar, or SAR, altimeter.
The altimeter will go bing, bong, bing, bong, bing, bong, sending a radar pulse, receiving a radar pulse, and it flies along and you build up the picture. The SAR altimeter sends a huge amount of pulses. So instead of bing, bong, it's more like it's really, really a huge amount of pulses.
Donlin says the Sentinel-6 will also be able to capture smaller sea level variations, closer to the coasts.
It'll give you a much more detailed picture at the local and regional level. That's the area where everybody's living and working, and that's where the coastal defences are. And that means that people can, A, prepare, and B, in the long term, start to think quite seriously about adaptation and mitigation.
This type of data is used in combination with lots of other measurements by scientists around the world trying to understand who's most at risk from rising seas. Quan Nguyen is one of them. He's an associate professor at Vietnam National University in Ho Chi Minh City.
So I think this gives a really a good data set, not only for scientists, but we can also translate the message into some action measures to recommend to the local central governments.
Action measures like building floodgates or dikes or planting mangrove forests to absorb higher storm surges. Nguyen's team uses satellite data on sea level, land elevation, land cover, and weather patterns to identify climate change hotspots in Vietnam. But he says satellite data is most useful in combination with on-the-ground measurements.
To make use of the remote sensing or satellite image, we need to validate the accuracy of this. So we need to have local data sets.
You can watch the Sentinel-6 satellite launch from a SpaceX rocket on Saturday from the European Space Agency website. The satellite will orbit around Earth every few hours for the next 5.5 years and send back a complete picture of our rising seas every 10 days. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
From looking down on Earth to looking up at space, an update now to a story we brought you earlier this week about the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, the iconic 900-ton radio telescope, the second largest one in the world. It was in danger earlier this month after a cable holding it up snapped. Today, the National Science Foundation's Sean Jones addressed the issue.
We understand how much Arecibo means to this community and to Puerto Rico. However, NSF has concluded that this recent damage cannot be addressed without risking the lives and safety of work crews and staff.
And so the sad news today, Arecibo will be dismantled. It is sad. For years, the Arecibo telescope was a crucial tool that's been used to listen out for messages from outer space. For its 57 years of operation, it survived hurricanes and earthquakes. Evidently, it could not survive 2020. If it were any year but 2020, a pretty significant event would be happening in Glasgow, Scotland right now, the 26th annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP26. When it was announced that COP26 would be postponed due to the pandemic, young people from across the globe said, nope, it's happening.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Mock COP's opening ceremony. We're so happy to be starting.
That's 18-year-old UK climate activist Josh Tregale officially opening Mock COP, a 2-week virtual event organized by young people for young people.
Climate crisis is not a problem of the future. It is happening right now, and it's high time we take action.
It's quite obvious that what we do.
On the docket, virtual workshops and panels, Mock COP's goal, to develop a list of demands for climate action. Mock COP kicked off today with a speech from the actual president of COP26, UK Business Secretary Alok Sharma.
You are vital in pushing all of us to go further, governments and regions, businesses and cities, schools, universities, by raising awareness and generating support and asking us to do more. That is one of the great benefits of this Mock COP.
But Mock COP isn't about elected leaders. It's about young people, very young, like Lysepria Kangujam.
I'm 9 years old. I'm an Indian climate activist. I'm fighting to save our planet and our future.
Kangujam said while COP26 can be delayed, climate action cannot.
People always tell me that you are too young to get involved in such activism. But I prove them that age doesn't matter to make a difference.
Just by moving the conference online rather than flying to meet in person, organizers say they're emitting about 50,000 fewer tons of carbon dioxide. Young people already delivering results. You rely on us here at The World to get to the bottom of big global stories. We take risks and we highlight communities impacted by the headlines. You can see who we are behind the microphones. Just visit theworld.org/whoweare, all one word. That's theworld.org/whoweare. So much of what we know about police brutality, we've learned from smartphone cameras. In France, a bill would make it illegal to share some images of police.
The police officers have to be protected, but the result should not be a burden for journalists.
Transparency versus police rights in France, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Two suspected attacks by Islamist extremists in the past month in France. In the wake of those events, France is having a national debate about Islam. French President Emmanuel Macron is firm on the French principles of secularism and free speech. He's calling on Muslim leaders to help reform the religion and adapt it to French values. He's also pushing a new proposed law that would crack down on, quote, Islamist separatism. Reporter Rebecca Rossman went to find out how French Muslims are feeling about all this. As she learned, that depends on whom you ask.
In early October, French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled the details of this upcoming law, aimed at fighting what he called Islamist separatism.
L'islam est une religion qui vit une crise aujourd'hui, partout dans le monde.
Islam is in crisis all over the world, Macron said during his speech. In recent days, the president has stopped using the word separatism to describe what he sees as the problem. Macron wants a couple of things.
Je l'espère, je le crois, de construire un islam des lumières dans notre pays.
The president says he wants to help create an Islam of the Enlightenment in France. In essence, he wants the religion to fit with French Republican values. Hakim El-Karoui is a Paris-based political consultant. He's written extensively about the threat of Islamist extremism and the need to create a quote-unquote French Islam. El-Karoui says he agrees with Macron that Islam is in crisis.
And I don't want to import the Islamic crisis in France.
He doesn't want to import the crisis, he says. He wants to address it. A lot of El-Karoui's ideas have been incorporated into the proposed law. It will be debated in Parliament next month. Among other things, the law would monitor international funding coming into French mosques. It would crack down on online hate speech. And, El-Karoui says, create a special certificate program for French imams.
And I think we need French intellectuals, French imams, French academics to think, to interpret, and to disseminate a modern interpretation of Islam.
El-Karoui says most French Muslims would agree with this. It's not the Islamic religion that's the problem, he says. It's when religious beliefs cross the line into political ideology. El-Karoui published a survey about French Muslims, and he found that nearly half of them say they feel well adapted to French society. He calls them the silent majority.
Why are they silent? Because they do consider that religion is a private matter. Their silence is included in the French model. This is the tricky thing, the challenging thing. We have to help them to speak.
This silent majority has a responsibility to speak up, El-Karoui says. They need to make it clear to the rest of France that the extremist version of Islam is an aberration. Rokhaya Diallo, a French journalist and filmmaker, could not disagree more with El-Karoui's notion that Islam itself needs reforming.
I think that religion belongs to people who have faith, and we have laws, and it's not up to the politicians, to the government, to intervene and to try to reframe a religion.
At a time when France is under a national lockdown and grappling with the aftermath of two gruesome terrorist attacks, Diallo says Macron should be focused on bringing the country together, not singling out this religious minority and conflating Islam with terrorism.
Certain people are trying to use the momentum to evict people, minorities who are, speaking out against racism, against Islamophobia, to disqualify them and to use the momentum to make people think that they may be connected with everything negative that is going on.
Take this protest. It was led by Génération Identitaire, a far-right organization that's described as a white nationalist group. After last month's attack at a church in Nice, the group immediately took to the streets waving banners that said, "Islam, get out of Europe." At a market in the working-class Paris suburb of Banlieue, you're just as likely to hear Arabic as you are French. At one stall, women are preparing msemen, a Moroccan flatbread served with sugary mint tea. Most of the people I speak with here are Muslims, and the majority of them say they haven't heard much about this so-called separatism law. What is separatism, one man responds when I ask for his opinion. A woman wearing a hijab interjects. It's a new law, she says, but it's not really clear. It's pretty confusing, actually. The woman gives her name as Jamila, and she says she's not sure if she's for or against the law, but she really doesn't like this word, separatism.
This is what we say for places that want to claim independence. It doesn't make sense here. French Muslims don't want to be independent from the state. This word separatism gives the wrong impression.
In another corner of the market, two men are drinking tea and sharing a snack. One of them is 30-year-old Abdel Hakim. He's Algerian, but he has been living in France for more than half his life.
En France, on aimerait bien entendre ce qu'on veut entendre.
He says in France, a lot of people, especially politicians, love to hear what they want to hear, not what the person in front of them is actually saying. And Macron, he says, is no exception.
Moi, je pense que les musulmans, c'est la plus grosse préoccupation du pays.
I think Muslims are this country's biggest preoccupation.
We know we've never been liked and never will be. So we just continue to live our daily lives and don't think about politics too much.
Regarding the proposed law, Hakim says his opinion doesn't matter. Macron will do what he wants. And the president will have no trouble finding an audience to tell him exactly what he wants to hear about Islam. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
There's another political debate playing out in France. Lawmakers are discussing a bill that would make it illegal to share pictures or video of a police officer with the intent of harming the officer. Violators would face up to a year in prison and a fine of more than $50,000. This has also sparked a big debate outside of the French parliament. Large crowds protested outside the French National Assembly building in Paris this week. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse the demonstrators. Activists say the proposed law could threaten press freedom. Pauline Adès-Mével is editor-in-chief of Reporters Without Borders and joins us from Paris. This debate has not come out of the blue, Pauline. Remind us, if you would, of recent events in France that pitted police against protesters and what the current state of that relationship is.
2019 has been a year with a very high number of incidents involving the police officers and journalists. Remember, there was this yellow jacket movement, some members protesting against social laws from President Macron, and reporters have been covering this movement and have been involved with violence from the yellow jacket people, but also from the police.
So that's a background to this debate in France. If this bill is passed, practically what would it do and how would it be enforced?
If the bill is passed, it will mean that on the ground, journalists will not be able to film the police live. They will have to make sure that they don't film the face. And if something happens, for example, and they are live, they could face some judicial complaint. The problem is also that physically it's very difficult to just film the police acting on the ground, but not their whole body. And it, of course, will have a very strong chilling effect on the rest of the journalists because no one wants to be interrupted, prevented to do the job on the ground, or sued for broadcasting such a picture. But the text as drafted does not concern all photos or videos of police. The police officer must be identifiable in the photo or video, and its dissemination must directly and deliberately seek to harm the police officer. And that's why we are asking some clarification, because we don't know what is meant by seek to harm the police officer. We do consider at Reporters Without Borders that the police officers, especially with the past 5 years in France, have to be protected. But the result of this protection should not be a burden for journalists.
Explain why changes like this embedded in this bill, why do they concern you? How do they threaten press freedom, do you think?
It will not make it possible for journalists to film live in proper condition in the field. They face a risk to be arrested. The debate over this is between journalists and the police. Journalists have the right to film the police on the ground, and they should keep this right. Otherwise, France will be the only country in the EU for having such restriction for journalists.
Why do you think France, of all the countries in Western Europe, has been willing to go this far with this kind of proposal?
Part of the reason given by the Ministry of Interior and the government is also that France police has faced a number of terrorist attacks. But once again, the burden shouldn't be on the journalist's shoulders. It's a different problem.
Supporters of the bill say it would protect police officers and their families. Police unions have pointed out that spouses of officers have previously been assaulted after videos of the officers were posted online. Do you think this law, this proposed law as it stands, would ensure those protections?
Well, the law, if it was less restrictive, could prevent the police officers and their families from being recognized, etc. But the measures should be less restrictive. You cannot prevent journalists from going live or ask them to film part of the body or not the face or put a blur just for the protection of the police.
Pauline, the parliamentary debates are supposed to end tomorrow. What do you think is going to happen? Will the bill pass?
Of course, if it's voted, it has to go to the other chamber of parliament, but there will be a very, very high controversy about the text and probably some other people demonstrating onto the streets.
Pauline Desmevel, editor-in-chief of Reporters Without Borders. She's been speaking with us from Paris. Pauline, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
It's been a record-breaking year for storms with names in the Atlantic. Central America suffered a 1-2 punch with hurricanes Eta and Iota this month. Nearly 200 people are feared to have died. Hundreds of thousands of people in coastal areas of Nicaragua and Honduras have been forced to leave their homes and seek emergency shelter. One aid group is working with children to help them cope with the devastation of the storms. That's today on The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
I'm joined by Veronica Zambrano, the Honduras country director for the children's charity Plan International, which has volunteers assisting in shelters in Honduras right now. Veronica, thank you for being with us. What's been the impact of these storms in Honduras? What are the conditions like in the shelters?
Thank you very much, Mark. Honduras is living one of the worst crises in its history. There has been 3 million people affected with the hurricanes. We have families and children that have been taken away from their homes and that they had to run into a shelter to survive. The condition in the shelters, it's also very difficult because ETA came and they were already saturated. So Honduras is going through a very, very, very difficult and sad time.
So 3 million people affected in a country of 9 million, fully a third of the country in one way impacted by these storms. And we got to remember there's COVID. I mean, surviving a hurricane, living through one would be a terrifying experience for anyone, but especially for kids. Destruction, death all around you. You're not knowing whether you and your family will survive. Maybe you've been separated from your family. We know intense storms have been linked to post-traumatic stress disorder and depression in young people. What kind of mental health impact does this have on kids?
We have to think about boys and we have to think about girls and we have to think of these emotional reactions that you have when you, as you were describing, you lose your house, you're taken out of your family, you're separated from your family and you have emotional reactions as fear, terror, insecurity. Then you go into the shelter and then you are bored, you're irritable, you are so sad, you don't know what it is happened. Of course, there is also reactions on their behavior, and maybe some of them will become in depression. They will feel apathy. They will be isolated, intolerant to things. And then is when violence comes in.
You're also active in providing services when storms have not had a major impact. Along with UNICEF, you run a project called Pro Niñez, which trains community psychologists and helps thousands of children get mental health services. Why is it important to have this infrastructure and training already in place before a storm?
When we work with children, with boys and girls, this helps them a lot to be resilient because you work in rights, self-esteem, life project, you become empowered. So when a crisis comes, you have built this resilience that makes you be able to receive the trauma in a better condition and also become out of the trauma also in a better condition, learning from that crisis.
So, Veronica, our segment on the show, The Big Fix, is all about climate change solutions. And it sounds like what Plan International is doing is providing solutions for kids affected by climate change. I guess that's where we're at in the world today. So let me ask you this. Storms like this are expected to get worse with climate change. What do we need to do differently to prepare kids for this new normal?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's exactly the origin of the problem. Honduras is the country most affected by climate change, in the words of the President of the Republic of Honduras. How can you believe that you can have 2 hurricanes 6 days apart, Eta and then Iota? Our children are receiving that. What happens now? We don't have the analysis of what this really is going to be the impact in the countries. What is going to happen with migration, with caravanas? Because people doesn't have anything to eat. And this is why the caravanas exist. And the migration from Honduras to Guatemala, to Mexico, to the USA. In what conditions? And they take children with them. So the problem and the impact is not yet in the agenda, but the cause is absolutely, as you have said, climate change.
Veronica Zambrano is the Honduras Country Director for Plan International. Thank you very much, Veronica, for speaking with us, and good luck with your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much for putting this in the agenda.
Think about your daily routine 8 long months ago and compare that to today. For many of us, logging onto Zoom or Skype from home has become our new reality, our new routine. It's true in cities and towns across the U.S. and also in a tiny Russian village called Stankevich, deep in Siberia. The World's Daniel Hoffman has our story.
That village, Stankevich, really is tiny. Just 39 people live there. And Alexei Dudaladov is one of them. Alexei is a student at the Omsk Institute of Water Transport. He also works on his family's farm, and over the past year or so, he's been posting videos on Instagram and TikTok showing off his daily routine.
Здорово, бандиты!
Поздоровайся с подписчиками, братишка! Ну давай!
In that TikTok, Alexei asks his goat to introduce itself to his subscribers. Many of Alexei's videos are just like that, hanging out with cows, chickens, and pigs on the farm, joking around and following the latest trends on Russian TikTok. But then the pandemic hit, and Alexei's studies went online. But Alexei had a problem.
Our village has really bad internet, so I found a solution. I climbed a birch tree. Up there, I got a pretty good signal, the internet was all right, so I started studying on the tree.
Alexei said that the higher he'd climb, the better the connection. But then he had another problem. It got cold.
Siberia has really harsh winters. It started getting really cold once November hit. So I got annoyed. I needed to find a new solution.
That solution was to record a new video, which Alexei posted on TikTok and Instagram.
Здравствуйте, уважаемый Александр Леонидович. К вам обращается студент Омского института.
In the video, Alexei appeals directly to the regional governor, Alexander Borkov. He introduces himself and describes his internet problem. The whole video is recorded from on top of the birch tree.
Ну понимаете, сейчас не май месяц на дворе.
It's no longer May, and now I'm sacrificing my health. I already had pneumonia before.
At the end of the video, Alexei asks the governor directly.
Alexander Leonidovich, I want to ask you on behalf of all students who have bad internet, how are we going to solve this problem?
That video, recorded in the middle of Siberia, got national attention. Over the past couple of days, Alexei has been in the headlines across Russia and now across the globe. And people have started offering help.
Someone from Belgium offered to send me a signal booster. Regular people in Russia offered assistance, but the government isn't helping anyone.
Alexei says that for the most part, politicians, and especially politicians in Moscow, don't care about small distant villages.
For us here in Russia, Moscow is like a separate government within this country. That's the truth.
But Alexei is taking it all in stride. He says he's not just posting videos for the hype. He wants to be able to study and have access to the same resources as other students. And he knows he's not the only student with bad internet access. He's been receiving messages from other students who have the same problem. As of today, though, he hasn't yet found a solution. But Alexei says he may know just the guy who could help.
Мы надеемся, что Илон Маск запустит свою...
Alexei says, we hope that Elon Musk sends out his internet satellite system here so that we can have high-speed internet everywhere, not just in the U.S., but also here in Russia. So if you're listening, Elon, help Alexei out. I told him I'd pass along the message. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
Well, sometimes you got to see it to believe it. You can find some photos of brave Alexei and the lengths or the heights he has to go to connect to the internet in his remote village. That's at theworld.org. Finally today, a story that'll wag you into the holiday spirit. Here's the world's Amanda McGowan.
It's that time of year again. Soon, every time you walk into a grocery store, pharmacy, or any public place, really, you'll be hit with this. But when it comes to hearing Christmas music around the clock for over a month straight, why should humans get to have all the fun? The British pet food company Tails.com is trying to change that this year.
Oh, good girl.
Squirrel.
Oh, good boy. Would you like to go on
walkies?
The song is full of sounds that dogs react to. Squeaky toys, doorbells ringing, people saying, dinner time. And that is by design.
We tested over 500 different sounds on our office dogs at Tails.com in focus groups.
Sean McCormick is the head veterinarian for Tails.com.
Figured out which ones they responded neutrally to, which ones they often responded positively to, either by tail wagging or cocking their head or, you know, averting their ears and twitching their ears or looking back at their owner to say, what's this?
Since dogs have more sensitive hearing than humans, there's even some high-frequency sounds woven in there that you or I couldn't hear. But there were other sounds that didn't make the final cut.
Anything that was kind of like telling them what to do, they were like, I'm not listening to you, person on the radio. So things like sedate and down and things like that just didn't work. We wanted it actually to be more joyful.
By the way, the song was mastered at Abbey Road Studios. Yeah, that Abbey Road Studios. And they wanted an album cover to mimic the iconic Beatles one.
We wanted to get, you know, the iconic shot of the dogs crossing the zebra crossing outside Abbey Road. But unfortunately, lockdown restrictions have prevented us doing that.
There may be no iconic album cover, but Tails.com is releasing a special vinyl edition of Raise the Wolf, with the proceeds going to a charity called Dudes and Dogs, which focuses on men's mental health. Since the song was released, people have been recording their own dogs' reactions and posting them to social media under the hashtag RaiseTheWoof2020. Online, you'll see lots of curious head tilts if you check it out. We did a quick poll of some dog owners in the world's newsroom. Producer Jess Yarmosky played the song for her dog, Scout. He loved it. Host Marco Werman's dog, Frankie... not so much.
I'm going to play you a little video, okay? I want you to tell me what you think. All right. Not a really impressive reaction.
He listened politely, but mostly just licked the table that the laptop was on, to each their own. For what it's worth, my cat Louie wasn't interested. For the world, I'm Amanda McGowan.
I don't know. How's your dog reacting right now? I'm going to give it another go with Frankie, but I'm expecting he'll just want a W-A-L-K. We're always online at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at GBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Sit. Treat.
Dinner time.
This. Treat.
Sit.
Sit.
Come on, buddy.
Come on.